Who wants to cast the first stone? Yes, sir. Arnold? Well, what inevitable high defense budgets? 15 years ago, the so-called defense budget was 9 to 10% of the national income. Today, it's 5 to 6%. Is that which is high? The fact is that the defense budget has been a scapegoat and not an explanation of the growth in government spending. What has actually happened is something very different. For some years, you are able to divert the pressure against the budget as a whole by cutting so-called defense spending and using it for these social welfare programs. But when you got to the point where the defense was being cut more than a large fraction of the population was willing to tolerate and became politically profitable to try to get a higher defense budget, the problem that we faced all along came out into the open, which was that government spending as a whole was growing more rapidly than the public at large wished to see it grow, was willing to pay for. You know, you go around the country and ask people, you're spending 40% of your income on government services, are you getting your money's worth? You aren't going to get many yeses. So the defense, now don't misunderstand me. Anything government does, it does inefficiently. The general rule, and it's one which is supported by a great deal of empirical evidence, is that on the average, it costs government twice as much to do anything as it costs in the private sector. If you compare the cost of government garbage collection with garbage collection by private entrepreneurs, if you compare the amount of work done by clerks in Social Security with clerks in private insurance companies, you make one comparison after another. One study that was done worldwide that I was fascinated by was a study of the cost of running buses, public transit buses. And Alan Walters, who is now an advisor to Margaret Thatcher, and someone else, I've forgotten who else, did this study. And they got data from a large number of countries and cities around the world, from Mexico City to Bangkok to New Delhi to Calcutta, to Great Britain, to the United States, and they compared costs, just costs per passenger mile, of buses operated by governments to buses operated by private enterprises, and the cost came out to be a little over 2 to 1. So anything government does costs twice as much, and I have no doubt the defense costs twice as much as it has to. But, unfortunately, I've never been able to figure out a way to turn defense over to private enterprise. I think that there are lots of things we could do that could cut down the size of defense. Other than that, but those get into the area of foreign policy. They aren't really into the area of economics. But my main point is a different one. I don't believe our primary problem is defense. The federal government is now spending on spending, the federal government alone, is now spending something like 25-28% of our national income. About 5% about that, about a fifth, and most a quarter is defense. Three quarters is not. The budget of the what used to be health, education, and welfare, and is now called human services, is much larger than the budget of defense. So that's where the real problem is. I'm also interested by all of this talk around about how, you know, it's terrible how our infrastructure is deteriorating. These bridges are falling down and the roads are breaking up. No doubt that's true. But it's kind of interesting to think about it. When those bridges were constructed, when those roads were constructed, the United States was much poorer than it is now. How come we were rich enough to construct them, but we're not rich enough to maintain them? And the answer is obvious. We are plenty rich enough to maintain them and construct them. But political pressures have meant that it is politically more profitable to divert that money to transfer programs than it is to maintaining the roads and the bridges and the public buildings. It's because government is always short-sighted, And the immediate political gain from the social programs is greater than the political gain from maintaining these public infrastructure, so we do the one rather than the other. Yes. Well, no, I didn't say that. Will Rogers said that. Don't give me credit for Will Rogers' marvelous statement. But thank God we don't get the government we pay for.
I wonder if, looking back on this survey of intellectual cycles over two centuries, you might speculate for us as to the cause, not only of the cyclical nature of the phenomenon, but of the recurring passion of intellectuals for liberal, that is, non-libertarian, non-liberal thought.
Yes, I think that's a very good and a very interesting question, and I'm not entirely satisfied with any answer I'm going to give you. But I do think there are some things you can say about it that are relevant. In the first place, the key thing about the market is that it's impersonal. And when you get things done by the market, there's no credit to an individual. The fact that somehow or other, people all around the world are cooperating to bring us many of the things that we enjoy, the suits you wear, for all you know, anything you look at. You know, there's that I have used very effectively, that wonderful piece that Leonard Reed once wrote about a pencil, which involves the cooperation of people in Malaya and so on all over the world. Now, you know, there was no, say, Henry Kissinger who got the credit for bringing all those people together and enabling them to cooperate with one another. So the market works impersonally and doesn't give credit to people. And who are intellectuals? Intellectuals are people who like to get credit. So do the rest of us. Some of us are satisfied with cash, but intellectuals want credit. I think that's one very important element. Another very important element, historically, and I go back now to the 19th century, to the emergence of Fabian socialism out of laissez-faire. Here, laissez-faire brought to Britain everything that its proponents had promised. You had an enormous period of progress in which the ordinary person in Britain achieved standards of living that had earlier been undreamed of. And just when you might have thought, well, now how come laissez-faire has been so successful? Why are the intellectuals turning away from it? Well, I think the answer is that the evils that are eliminated fade from your memory and are not obvious. Nobody can see the evil that isn't there. Yesterday, upon the stair, I met a little man who wasn't there. Now, on the other hand, there remain evils. And indeed, the remaining evils are all the more prominent for those that have been eliminated. When 3/4 of the population is living in abject poverty, that's taken for granted as a natural state of affairs. When instead of 3/4 of the people living in abject poverty, 1/10 of the people are living in abject poverty, that stands out like a sore thumb. And it's very natural on all of us, not only intellectuals, to attribute to the system the evils which it hasn't eliminated. And to say, for God's sakes, we got to do something about this. Next, in the British case, the very success of laissez-faire made it possible to do something about it. Because the success of laissez-faire, the fact that government had no powers, meant that it was possible to develop an incorruptible bureaucracy. There was nothing to corrupt them for. After all, if you didn't need a permit to import goods and services. You know, remember, go back for a while, a century earlier, the British bureaucracy was one of the most corrupt, it was widely known to be corrupt. In the period of tariffs, there was widespread scandals. There were the rotten boroughs, there was all of the, we get the idea, sometimes we used to get the idea of Britain as having a natural incorruptibility, but that's a bunch of nonsense. It was a country where smuggling was rife, where you had a lot of bribery and corruption. But what happened in the 19th century was that you eliminated all sources. You didn't have to smuggle because you had free trade. You didn't have to get a permit to set up a business because anybody could set up a business. As a result of which, you were able to develop an incorruptible, an honest civil servant service, which was then available for you to use to correct some of these evils, which were left out after government, which were still left as a result after the operations of the free market. Now, that's a special case, and the more general case, I think, comes back to the fact that intellectuals are people who pride themselves on the use of reason and who all of us have a natural inclination to think that we ought to be able to figure out a way of handling things that's better than the way in which things will develop on their own. That you ought to have coordination and planning, that must be better than leaving things to work in the ordinary fashion. The market is a very sophisticated instrument. It's a very hard thing for people to understand. It's very easy for people to understand that if there's something wrong, by God, you get somebody to do it. Do something about it. It's very hard for them to understand that maybe that'll make things worse, and that if you leave it alone, maybe you'll get better results than if you don't. And finally, and most important of all, intellectuals are paid for writing. They're paid for being critics. You don't have much of an audience for Pollyannas. I have been fascinated in recent years by the enormous market for doom and gloom. What are the best-selling books? You look down the list of the books. It's the Harry Browns. It's the Ruffs. You name them. All of the people who are saying that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, and you better get yourself a little place in the woods and pack away some dried food there and have a few gold coins with which you can throw at the people who are going to come and try to take you over. There's a market for that kind of thing. And in general, I think there is a better market of intellectuals. They're subject to market forces just as everybody else is. And the kind of ideas which will be popular and which will develop, which will be those ideas which can earn their producers and their distributors a living in the marketplace. And as I say, I think that in the first place, tends to make intellectuals critics of the existing order, whatever it is. Made them critics of laissez-faire. It has turned them, in part, into critics of collectivism and socialism. But in the main, there's a better market for people who tell you positive solutions, positive ways, even though they won't work, but positive ways of how to solve your problems than there are for people who are going to say, you know, there's not much you can do about it. You better reconcile yourself, as Adam Smith put it, to the mediocrity of your circumstance. Yes?
How would you fit the environmental movement, particularly the anti-market aspects, into that history of ideas that you were raising?
Well, the environmental movement is a very simple case of a group where a small elite wants other people to pay for providing them with the amenities that they would like. Because the costs of the environmental movement are mostly borne by the lower income groups, and the benefits are derived mostly by upper income groups. Who are the people who go and use these wilderness areas? I don't believe there are very many steel workers who are fans of the wilderness area. You don't see many blue-collar workers out there. So that in the main, I think that's a very simple case of self-interest. Now, again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying people deliberately set out to fool the public. I'm not saying that at all. You've got to fool yourself first. But everybody is capable of knowing that what's good for him is good for the country. As you know, Armin Alchin is always fond of saying there's one thing you can count on everybody to do, and that's to put his interest above yours. Yes.
Are you bothered at all by the recent announcements of the Fed? Do you think that they're going to start chasing interest rates again?
Oh, I have been bothered not by the recent pronouncements by the Fed. I don't pay much attention to the pronouncements by the Fed, but I have been very much bothered not by the recent, but by the 60-year behavior of the Fed. There is no institution in the United States that has so high a public opinion and so poor a record of performance. And that's not simply in the last 6 months or the last 2 years. It is literally for the last 60 years. Here is an institution which was set up to prevent banking panics and brought us the most severe banking panic the U.S. ever experienced in 1933. Here was an institution which was set up to provide control over the quantity of money so as to avoid inflation or deflation. That brought us a doubling of prices during the First World War, a doubling of prices during the Second World War, a tripling or quadrupling of prices after the Second World War. An institution that was set up to promote stability and has brought us, over its 60-year period, a record of very sharp ups and downs in monetary growth and has undoubtedly contributed to instability. So I am very much troubled by the behavior of the Federal Reserve, and particularly, I agree, the last 2.5 years has been a particularly bad stretch. They are not changing their policy in any way. Now they're just behaving the way they've been behaving for the last 2.5 years. They are behaving as if the only way in which they can drive down the center of the road is by having walls on each side and bouncing off one world at war and then bouncing off the other and then bouncing back. You just look at the record. Monetary growth, negative, from October 79 to April 80, plus 11 or 12% a year from April 80 to April 81, minus 0.2% from April 81 to October 81, plus 14 or 15% from October 81 to January 82, 1.4% from January 82 to July 82, and over 14% from July 82 to now. Now, that's no way to run a railroad or a country. And we are, I may say, I am very much concerned. I believe this is you get me off on this and we're here all night. But I believe that most of the short-run economic difficulties that the Reagan administration has faced has not been due to Congress, has not been due to the administration, but has been due to this erratic policy of the Federal Reserve. It meant curtailing inflation was bound to cause unemployment and a temporary period of difficulty. But we have paid much higher price than was necessary. If you had had sensible monetary policy, the recession would not have ended in the summer of 1980. It would have continued on into the summer of 81. At that point, it would have been succeeded by a healthy, steady recovery that we would be in the middle of right now, and that would have several more years to go. Inflation would have come down just as much as it did. Interest rates would have been drastically lower. Government deficits would have been much lower because there wouldn't have been as high unemployment. There wouldn't have been the same debt payments. There wouldn't have been the same political resistance to cutting government spending. Now, just as the erratic policy which the Fed followed in 1980 and 81 has produced this very long recession we've been going through, I believe that what they're now engaged in has a distinct chance of producing a replay of that episode. We are going to be in a recovery in the next few months, no question about it, because we've been in a monetary explosion and it's got to go somewhere. Well, what I am very much concerned about in the short run is that that monetary explosion will send us into a recovery which will duplicate the 80-81 recovery in the sense that it will last about 12 months. And that along about July, August of next year, the Fed will get very much worried and the market will make it get worried because interest rates will have jumped up. And it will step on the brake again and veer to that other wall. And that will drive us into another recession at the end of 83 and through early 84. That, I am afraid, is not a very pretty prospect. And yet I think, from my perspective, it's at least a 50-50 chance. Yes. Not you, hold back there. I don't think we ought. I think we ought to separate issues. Maybe we ought to withdraw from NATO, but that's a separate issue to be considered on its own grounds. I don't agree with those people who say that somehow or other, on grounds of equity, defense has to contribute in order to justify some other cut. That's a bunch of nonsense. Defense is the first object, the first requirement on government. That's what government is fundamentally established for. We ought to decide on how much we spend for defense on the basis of what our needs are for defense. We ought to decide whether we're in NATO or not in NATO on the basis of whether that is desirable or not desirable from our defense. I'm not at the moment expressing a view on that. I have a view, and I'd be glad to say it. But it's utterly irrelevant to the question of financing a deficit on Social Security. Don't mix up horses and apples. Don't use bad arguments for good objectives. I think you do far more harm to your cause than you do good by mixing these things up. Argue the defense issue on its terms and argue the Social Security issue on its terms. And in the first place, converting the Social Security into a privatizing it into a voluntary program does not produce any deficits, which aren't there already. You have an unfunded obligation. And if you were to measure the debt of the U.S. government on a proper accrual basis, it would not be a trillion dollars. It would be something like $6 or $7 trillion, because it would include these unfunded obligations. That's already there. There's no further deficit that you're producing. So separate these issues and don't mix them up. You had one more. You had. Well, let me take that up. That's a very complicated question, and I'm going to be dogmatic in order to keep the answer down to a reasonable length, because I don't want to keep you here till tomorrow morning. But first, I think it is inherent in the system. I have been in favor of abolishing the Federal Reserve System for more years than some of the people in this room have lived, because fundamentally you have a system with no bottom line. The members of the board are appointed for 14 years and cannot be reappointed, so they have no bottom line. The Federal Reserve doesn't have to go to Congress for a budget because it prints its own money. The employment in the Federal Reserve System is the closest thing to lifetime employment that the United States has. You have, therefore, a system with no bottom line. It's a bureaucracy subject to outside influence, but not to any effective control. And the phrase I have used over and over again is borrowed from Poincaré's famous statement that war is too important to be left to the generals, and I've always argued money is too important to be left to the central bankers. So I am not I believe it is inherent in the system, and I am reinforced in that belief by the fact that the same problems have arisen under a whole succession of different people. You've had various people in as chairman of the board or as members of the board, some of whom have been very able, some of whom have been mediocre, some of whom have been very politically neutral, some of whom have not been. But the results seem to have been the same regardless of who's been in there. So I conclude it is inherent in the system. Now the question is, what ought you to do about it? And there you can have many different reforms, depending on the level at which you want to talk, how radical you want to make your reform to be. A minor reform, the least radical reform, would be to make the Federal Reserve System, let it stay in existence, but make it a Department of the Treasury. That would at least give you some political control over it, have some element of responsibility, prevent the division of responsibility that you now have for fiscal versus monetary matters. A more radical reform, and one which I would prefer, would be essentially to eliminate the Federal Reserve and replace it by a constitutional amendment specifying a rate of increase in high-powered money, which would not require that you have this whole apparatus of member banks, of reserves, or anything like that. Now, on the main issue you're raising, I believe I am in favor of having free competition in the issue of money or of deposits. I believe people ought to be free to use anything they want to as money. But I do not believe that that would have the consequences that Fritz Hayek believes that free banking would have. I have observed that there is enormous social advantage to having a single money, effective money. I have observed that you have over and over again tended to concentrate on one money. And my own view is that, in fact, in practice, unless the government money is enormously mismanaged, much more, even worse than ours, it will win the battle hands down because it has the advantage of having been established. But I would like to eliminate any obstacles to private issuance of money, but I don't think it needs to be. I think that there is a case to be made for a government issue of money under conditions controlled by a constitutional amendment, preferably, which would severely limit the quantity that could be emitted. Now, as I say, this is an argument that can go on for a long time. There are many things to be said on many sides of it, but let me just add one more thing. There's a lot of talk about gold standards, and the most fascinating thing about that talk is that if you take 100 people who are in favor of gold standards and put them into a room and find out what they mean by that, you will get 100 different gold standards. There is no more relationship between the kind of gold standard that Art Laffer and Jack Kemp are talking about, and Lou Lehrman, I may say, and the kind of gold standard that Ron Paul is talking about. There is no more connection between those two than there is between the people who say they are against a gold standard and those who are for it. They are altogether different things. So that the appearance of support for a gold standard is very deceptive. There's much less support for it than there really is. I would myself support an honest-to-God gold standard. Ron Paul is the only person around who is talking about what I think is a real honest-to-God gold standard. I don't think it has a chance of a snowball in hell of being adopted. But it might be a pretty good system if it were adopted. All of these other half-compromised proposals, what I called in the talk I gave at the Mont Pelerin Society 20 years ago, pseudo-gold standards. They are snares and delusions. They're only going to get you back into the mess you've been in. Don't fall for them. Thank you.
Milton, on behalf of all of us, thank you very much for a very stimulating talk, which we will long remember. The meeting stands adjourned until we reconvene tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., in the French Room. Tomorrow's activities from 10 in the morning till 5:30 will be in the French Room and the Pavilion Room, and we'll see you then. Thank you all.